The EMS Educast is a podcast by and for EMS educators. Every week, our panel of education experts hosts a program that brings you the latest and greatest in EMS education technology, methods, and techniques. Your hosts will regularly bring you guests from all over the world to tell you about innovative EMS education programs and experiences in other places. Join us each week for the EMS Educast. And visit www.emseducast.com to subscribe with iTunes or the RSS feed, listen to archived shows, and view future show descriptions. The EMS Educast.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 134 of the EMS Educast. I'm Rob Terrio, and with me tonight is Bill Toon. Greg Fries, unfortunately, couldn't make it with us tonight. And this evening, we're talking about credentialing with a special guest by the name of John Friesen. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Good to have you here. So Bill knows you, and so I'm at a disadvantage. I don't know anything about you at all. And Bill, you're going to promise me to say nice things about John, right?
Absolutely. I would think of nothing else to say. Now, Rob, you heard another story.
That's true. See, one thing I've learned about Bill, so Bill and I have actually never met face-to-face, but the one thing I've learned about Bill is if he's giving you a hard time, it means he likes you, I think. Would that be fair?
Of course. John, what would you say?
I think that's a fair assessment. I'll put it this way. I hope that's a fair assessment, Rob.
Otherwise, we're both in trouble. So, John, thanks for joining us on the show, and we are talking about credentialing. And before we get started, maybe you can tell us a little bit about yourself and your origins in EMS, how you got started, and how you ended up in the position you're in, and then tell us a little bit about that position and what you do.
Sure. And leave no stone unturned.
Yeah. No stone.
The show is only an hour.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Reader's Digest version.
Okay.
Is I got my start with a small volunteer service here in South Central Kansas, and that was back in the day where you joined, saw if you liked it, and then you went to EMT class, which is what they did with me, and got hired on full-time for City of Newton Ambulance here in South Central Kansas, been in that area all the time. Went to paramedic school and worked there for a while and sort of worked my way up. Became the training officer there, and then eventually deputy chief. About 16 years into it, thought, well, there are probably other things to do. So I went over and worked at Hutchinson Community College as a for the EMS program there, and did that for 3.5-4 years in that area before Cedric County was working at the wrong place. Kind of by that, but took heed and went to work for Cedric County. Yeah, it is nice to be headhunted. And sometimes the headhunting actually is a job you want, too. So for Cedric County, I'm a while in training division. And in 2004, the city and county went together in a joint agreement and hired a full-time medical director. And when that person came on board, one of the first things she did is said, I've got to have some staff. And out of that request, I got transferred from EMS over to the office of the medical director as the education manager, and that's what I've been doing since. And I guess a quick summary of that role is I do a couple of things. I work with all of our agencies. We have about 800 providers in the system. I work with the agencies to define and develop clinical education, and then also do a lot of work with helping the trainers improve their skill set in the classroom, both in lecture presentation and skill teaching. So that's really my bailiwick. We have a couple of unfunded positions, which is just sort of the norm here in this climate financially. One of those is clinical practice. And so as Bill can attest, I sort of step into that role. He and I have been trading things back and forth over the past month on a couple of projects that we both happen to be working on. But it's in that clinical practice role where I worked with the medical director to develop the credentialing process that we began using. And I've really sort of spearheaded that project since it began in 2008. So that's the brief version.
And 800 providers, how many services would that be?
Well, we have three big services, Rob. Sedgwick County EMS is a third service EMS agency in Sedgwick County. And then we have two large fire departments. We have the City of Wichita Fire Department and Sedgwick County Fire Department. So between those three organizations, that comprises about 650 to 700 providers somewhere in that area.
I find that term third service really puzzling. The first time I heard that, I was at EMS Today in Baltimore, and someone was asking me about the service I work for here in Canada, and they said, oh, you're a third service. And I just looked at them rather puzzled, said, third, what does that mean, third service? Because it's a totally foreign concept here. So third service means not fire, correct?
Yeah, not fire.
Yeah.
So
okay.
I guess not, the first two services are police and fire. So
yeah, that's just so odd because they're, for me anyway, is that common language in the United States that does everyone refer to it that way when it's not fire-based?
Well, yeah, very much so. There would be the public utility model as well that would be kind of crafted out as a separate model.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that the typically you think of the classic or police, fire, and emergency medical services are the three uniform services. The thing is EMS, third service is typically associated with a city or county run and supported EMS agency versus a contracted provider versus a hospital-based service versus a volunteer service. You know, it usually has that kind of camp to it.
Yeah. I just found the language odd because we probably fewer than 2% of services in Canada are fire-based. John, you do credentialing, and so my understanding from talking with Bill before the show is that EMS providers work under the license of the medical director for whom you work with. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, that's a fair statement. Yep.
Yeah, okay. And so you provide quality assurance then and continuing quality improvement for the providers in that region?
Yeah, and that, you know, boy, that, Rob, that's probably a whole nother topic because doing that from a systemic stance with that many providers and eight different agencies in total, the whole idea of quality assurance and quality improvement that's a pretty big thing to get your arms around. And so the Office of the Medical Director has that responsibility, and I should be very honest to say that's a work in progress.
Right. So would it be kind of a medical oversight to ensure compliance with directives and protocols? Maybe instead of me asking a whole series of questions, maybe you can just explain sort of what the role of your office is exactly.
Sure. We view that we have three different areas of focus that reside under the medical director within the Office of the Medical Director. One of those is education and training. And so that is, again, working with all of the system agencies to develop and deliver a consistent and thoughtful clinical education track each year. The second focus would be that of clinical practice, which, as you mentioned, Rob, would be things like protocols and procedurally how the medical director wants things done. So that would be the part of our office that would work on protocol development and protocol compliance, keeping those contemporary, as well as how we approach different scenes and types of illnesses and injuries and what preference there is for skills and how skills are done, so procedural issues. And then the third is that of quality. And so our office is really very much in process of trying to bring data together from the eight different agencies, which includes dispatch, to put that data into a format where we can track it from receipt of call through discharge from the hospital. And begin to then see, you know, where we're having impact and where we need to improve. So those are the three areas of focus that we have.
Do you get data from the services electronically so you can see where the strengths and weaknesses are in terms of protocol compliance?
Well, the answer to that is yes, but not to the degree that we want. And so that, again, that's the challenge. The two large fire service providers use Firehouse software to do their reporting. EMS is using another product. So trying to get those things matched up as well as to get the data out of the hospitals. We have two level one trauma centers within the county, which is really pretty unusual for our size. Our county population is in the area of 500,000 people. And so to have two level ones within a mile of each other is an interesting thing. And so we're trying to, from them, pull trauma information, STEMI, stroke information, and get that laid out. So that really has been, that position within our office wasn't funded for some time, and we're just now in the process of developing mechanisms to take all of that data and put it together to get the full picture. It's safe to say that the individual agencies have a pretty good idea of what they're doing, but to get the full picture has been very difficult for us, and that's a work in progress.
So if there was, let's say, a breach in compliance with protocol in the field, would the service typically contact your office and say this is what's happened, or is there a responsibility on the individual provider to contact you to say, you know, I screwed up or I made a medication error or something of that nature?
Individual providers report that to their agency, and then their agency would bring that forward to us. And so that would be the typical pathway for error reporting in our system.
And, Bill, feel free to jump in at any time. I just have one other another question. Do you, let's say, medical directives change, you know, things are advancing, the new CPR ACLS guidelines are out, and you work with the services to disseminate that information. Is that education done primarily by those services with your assistance and guidance?
Yeah, one of the things that our initial medical director requested and then ultimately required was that to teach clinical education within our system, she required that you attend what we call our medical training officer course. And so it's about a 36-hour course on teaching in the clinical setting. So it's a bit about how do you present lecture or didactic information, how do you teach skills, how do we go about evaluation, and what are the concepts and theories that the Office of the Medical Director really wants to push in that way. So each agency identifies people that they're going to use to teach in the system, and they go through this course that we teach in-house. So whether they're a state-certified training officer or instructor coordinator, we still have them to try and align the values that we're going to take into the classroom. And then my job is to work with them to continue that focus on how we want to present education within the system. And that, we've had a medical director change. Dr. Catherine Young was our medical director up until 2010, at which point Dr. Sabina Braithwaite, Dr. Young left, and Dr. Braithwaite came in, and she has continued that idea that we want to really be careful about providing a consistent message. So when we roll out, for example, a basic life support training or education class, we'll do that in a way where we work through a course development process that all of the stakeholder agencies are a part of. They send someone in to be a part of that development team, and we get the product that we want. Then we run through a train-the-trainer process before it's then taken out and delivered. And so it may be delivered by individual departments within their own classroom setting, or it might be that we do joint training, and it just depends on the topic as well as what schedules are looking like. Of course, our fire service partners, that one of the disadvantages they have is they've got a whole multitude of things that they have to spend time training on. So we're often trying to work within the framework of a pretty complex schedule there when we want to do things in a collaborative fashion.
Mm. So how many, with that many providers, that many services, I would imagine there's education going on almost 365 days a year at one place or another, is it?
Yeah, it's pretty much in process at any given time. And so we'll have down times where we don't have things going, but rather we're in development phase. The fire service agencies, they tend to want to be in the classroom doing clinical training when it's really hot or really cold. And when the weather's nice, they want to go out and do the suppression and rescue training. So they'll kind of align their schedule in that way. And then EMS, the transport agency, will be more consistent throughout the year in delivering their training and education.
Yeah, that sort of makes sense. And do you spend any or much time in the classroom directly teaching, or are you mostly sort of organizing all that in the background?
Most of my time is spent in organization development and guidance. So if they want guidance, or if we see something that we want to give guidance on, then I'll step in at that point. But my days of standing in front of the classroom or getting down on my knees and teaching skills, those have been few and far between for the past couple of years.
Right. And so when it comes to new directions or ideas, things that come up, for example, like STEMI or PCI bypass or stroke, does that usually come from your office, or do the services sometimes contact you and say, can we look at this program or look at this new treatment? Can we add this to our scope of practice? How does that work?
We see that both ways, Rob. We will have agencies come and say, hey, we've learned about this. What would it take to begin doing this or incorporating it into a protocol? And the office itself has been pretty active in pushing concept forward. It's kind of interesting how that works. Sometimes, in a good example, we're just in the process of adopting the pit crew approach on cardiac arrest and stepping into cardiocerebral resuscitation as well. And we had from OMD the idea that that's where we wanted to go, but we also thought we needed to move a little bit slower in order to get the buy-in to do that. And what was interesting is we started with an initial clinical practice meeting to roll out the long-range plan, and it was the agency representatives who said, let's just get it done. This is where we need to go. So it's a pretty healthy give and take both directions there, and that feels pretty good.
That pit crew model has come up a couple of times, and Bill, I think you even mentioned it once and may have described it, but I'm having a TIA now. Where did that pit crew concept come from, and can one of you just briefly describe it?
John, I insist. Please, you're the guest.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the doctor's name down in South Florida. Dr. Robert, is it Tomer?
You're correct. Right, it does come out of it does come out of the South Florida, but it's been popularized by agencies such as Wake and as well as Austin County.
Yeah.
And it's continued to grow, out of that. But the pit crew concept, very simply, is Rob, you're familiar with race cars?
Oh yeah.
NASCAR racing, and it's that same concept. If you ever watch a race car crew, that when a car comes into the pit, everyone's got an assigned role in the process. And the whole idea is to do the same thing with a cardiac arrest, is have everyone have clearly defined roles, and that's what they do during the cardiac arrest. And with the idea of providing efficient and effective cardiac arrest care is the principle there. So, yeah. And it even falls a little bit into the incident management structure that the fire department is very much familiar with.
And is there some sort of spreadsheet or algorithm that describes the different roles somewhere on the internet? Or
Oh yeah, I'm sure if you did EMS pit crew, you certainly would find it. But it's been presented and written in some of the trade journals about the concept already. And I know John's developed it, modified it for their system, taking other people's ideas and modified it for what their system works like.
Mm-hmm.
John, jump in.
Oh yeah, absolutely. In our case, we took information out of Austin Travis County, and then also worked. Bill and I have been sharing information back and forth on that, and it was a matter of piecing it together in a way that we really felt it would work well with the way our system is structured. And once we got through a couple of drafts and felt like, we think this is going to work, that's the point at which we brought in boots from the ground, so to speak, the folks who are out doing it every day. And we sat them down, talked them through it, answered questions, and then we turned them loose in the lab and let them refine it to the point where they said, this will work for us. And we feel that was fundamental to getting a product that we're going to be able to launch and see some results from.
That's interesting. I think I'm just trying to think, when it comes to arrest management, I guess we sort of do that, but it's not structured with, specific details or anything. When I run arrest, everything just seems to get done, and not too many people are knocking each other over in the process, but I like the concept. I think I can explore it a little bit further, and maybe incorporate it into our classroom here. And
I would even say that if you think about it, the pit crew concept before that name was called, if you look at some of the early trauma centers, the level one trauma centers, they often had very defined roles and positions. You could even go into some trauma centers and there's foot places painted on the floor where each particular person is supposed to be, that's part of the team, and what role they're supposed to have while they're in that position. And you'll see that done. And I've seen that in U.S. institutions that have done that to really define clearly what's going on. And that came around even before I've seen it adopted by EMS in the field.
I thought those footmarks were just so they could break out into a musical after the trauma patient was transferred to CT.
Typical Canadian.
Well, it's a little celebration when they leave the room, so... So what have been some of your challenges and your highlights in that role?
Well, before we go into that, Rob, I'm going to draw us back into away from the pit crew here for a little bit and come back to it. And let's really talk, John, what took you down the road of credentialing? Where was the germination of it, and what are the steps that you've gone through to get to this concept of EMS credentialing? Because I would have to say it is done in other systems, but it is not a uniform practice, I would say, that is done across the country.
Oh, I would agree with that, Bill. You're asking a great question about how did it come up, and I think sometimes there are some of us that wish it hadn't ever come up, if we're honest about it. But the National EMS Scope of Practice, if you go to that document and thumb through it, one of the things that you find is a little graphic that's got four circles that mostly overlap. And those circles are the initial education circle, so the things you learn when you go through your class to become an EMT or a paramedic or whatever other level of provider you are. And then there's another circle that's called certification, which by their definition is the certification that the sponsoring institution gives to you. So whether it's a community college or a hospital program or just who it is. The third circle is that of licensure, which is what the state or national registry grants through their processes. And so your state may call that certification, but and that's what we are in Kansas. We're certified providers, but the Attorney General's office is pretty clear to say certification, licensure, it's the same thing spelled a different way. Just don't tell nursing. And that's a little joke for you, Bill. But
Thank you.
The fourth circle is that of local medical credentialing. So that is, that's where the concept started here locally. And when the city and county worked out their agreement for the provision of EMS service that assigned the transport and EMS responsibility to Sedgwick County, one of the things in that document was that the full-time medical director would develop and run a local credentialing process. And so it remains in the contract today. And Dr. Young looked at that and began to ask the question, well, okay, what exactly is that? And we did a fair amount of asking around. Austin Travis County, when Dr. Ed Rock was there, began doing some of that. So we had some discussion there with Dr. Rock. We did literature searches. We asked the National Registry and some other folks that are prominent throughout the U.S. to give us some advice. And the overwhelming response that we got back was, well, there's really nothing written about how EMS does this. So it's in the National EMS Scope of Practice document, but it's not like you can ring up a service and say, hey, send us your description, your document for how you do that. So we sat down again with providers and we said, tell us what it is that makes for a minimally competent first responder or EMT or paramedic in our system. And we did a lot of work to define that. And then once we had that definition, we asked, all right, so now we have the definition, what is it that those people should know and be able to demonstrate? And we came up with another list from that. And that then became the information that we went to work asking, how would we look at this and determine that someone has, and I'm going to use a term here that's caused us problems, minimal competency. And it's probably really important to stop for a moment and define what is minimal competency, because most of our technicians and, providers have, Bill doesn't like that word, Rob. I don't know if you've ever caught that.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them view minimal competency as incompetent. And we've had to do a fair amount of work to reframe that to say, we really want to know, does a person know basic practice standards? In other words, we're okay with them working in the field, delivering care to people. And so from that, this group of folks from all of our stakeholder agencies decided that the way to approach that was to develop a valid and reliable exam, written exam, and then to develop a valid and reliable practical exam that would be done as well by the person in the credentialing process. So we went to work on those things. I didn't have any experience with developing valid and reliable examinations, and so we actually reached out to Johnson County, and Mark Terry and Bill came down and helped us learn a bit about how to do that process, and of course a fair amount of our own reading and education to work at developing questions that had both validity and reliability that were vetted by average field providers. And if they questioned whether it was valid or not, and we couldn't fix it, we threw it out. We, on our written exam in the document that I sent, we showed the blueprint for the exam, how many C1, C2, C3 questions in each of the categories that were defined. So we give them that blueprint to study from, to prepare from. And all of the questions have been worked through a process to determine cut scores. And then we use a software product called Prosper, which was a Pearson product and I believe has been bought out by Scantron now. But we bubble sheet the exams and we run them through. So we get the bicerial point value on questions and we're forever more working at trying to strengthen that examination, adding new questions and making sure that questions are contemporary with the protocols. So that's the written component. And then the practical component of the exam, they come in and they do two practical stations in a contrived scenario. One is a cardiac arrest. And so both our basic life support providers and our advanced life support providers are expected to be able to walk into a cardiac arrest and apply a protocol to their level, their scope of education and training. And then the second is what we call a protocol-based scenario, that they actually draw the scenario out of an emesis basin, interestingly enough, in the lab to determine which one they're going to run. Yeah, it's a nice touch. And they then run that. What we're looking for in those is we've identified, again, with our stakeholders from the agencies, we identified what are the critical criteria for the different skill sets that are going to be shown in that scenario. And that's what our evaluators are using to determine whether it's a pass or a fail in the skills scenario. So then in addition to those two things, we also get a sign-off from their agency administrator that basically says they're not under investigation by the state. They don't have convictions. In other words, the director or chief is saying, we feel comfortable putting this person forward to be credentialed by the medical director. And we also take a look at, for advanced life support providers, their IV success rate, and we look at their ability to manage a critical airway, and that's done by retrospective review. We have criteria that we spell out there. And for BLS providers, we look at their ability to handle a critical airway as well, and that, again, is retrospective review. So once they've worked through those things and met that criteria, then they are pushed forward to Dr. Braithwaite for signature and credentialing, and they go through that process every 4 years. That's a kind of a down and dirty description of the process.
Every 4 years, I like that. We do it annually, and it kind of wears on you after a few years. So.
Oh yeah, we would like to see the people more than every four. But doing it every four is really, I mean, you said a mouthful right there. It wears you out.
Well, I mean, it wears me out as the one being tested on an annual basis. But to me, 3 years is probably reasonable. 4 years is a bit of a stretch, but not bad on the whole.
John, I was going to ask. So how far along, I was looking through your credentialing manual, and I noticed that it appears that you're trying to do a section. So you are almost credentialing a group of people every year, and the hope is at the end of 4 years, every provider has been at least through the credentialing process once before you start going through it again. Would that be correct?
That's the theory, and boy, that's the key word right there is theory. Of course, the employees, that's not a static group. They come and they go. And so we've really struggled with the idea that, you know, how do you do that to ensure that you're touching people every 4 years and someone doesn't get lost in the shuffle? And so we, of course, have our spreadsheet. And the other thing that we're looking at and beginning to move towards is the idea that when you hire on, that you will credential before the end of your 1 year probationary period. But again, we started in 2008. The first year was a beta year. We did 100 people in that year, not 200, to sort of get our feet under us. And we also were able to determine a lot of things in the critical set of skills that we developed that didn't have validity that needed to be thrown out. And so what we found is it's hard for agencies even to necessarily keep track of who's due next and who hasn't gotten into the system because they came after the project started. So we wrestle a bit with that. And we continue also to refine every year. So What I sent you, that document is really the second iteration of what this looked like. We used to, for example, with paramedics, we looked at intubation success rate, but we quickly realized here in the past couple of years that we were likely looking at the wrong thing, encouraging something there that we don't necessarily want to see more of, and we also don't define as being always the proper management of the critical airway. So thus, the airway criteria went through a change. In talking with Dr. Braithwaite, we actually had the discussion yesterday as we were talking about me doing this tonight, that we're really poised to go into the next iteration of what this looks like. And we think it'll look quite a bit different with, maybe the way to describe it is, it will look less like a test and look more like a mandatory track of education with testing included in it. We do surveys with providers once they've gone through this, and one of the things that we hear from them repeatedly is to say, you know, I want to do it right, but I need someone to help show me that. I can't just walk in and do that. And so we're really trying to pay attention to that kind of feedback as we think about what's our next step and what does this look like the next round when we go into it. So it's very much a dynamic process.
John, you kind of tippy-toed around the intubation issue and skills, maintenance skills, evaluation piece. Do you have kind of a number that you look for, a minimum number of tubes on an annual basis, and do you define a failed intubation a certain way or successful intubation a certain way?
We define an attempt as the blade passes the lips. So that's an attempt.
Mm-hmm.
And when we were using that as the criteria for what we were looking at with medics, Rob, one of the things that we found is there are enough variables in there that when you look at a percentage, and let's say a technician has a 60% percentage in intubation success, defined by you went in and you got the tube placed. Well, the variables are, we can't control what kind of airways that person gets. And so I might get a string of clean airways in 2011, and you got a string of really dirty, bad airways in 2011. Mm-hmm. People with no necks and heavy set and, you know, all of those confounders. So the numbers don't necessarily give you a true picture of whether a person has competence there or not. The other one of the other variables in that is whether the person needed to be intubated or not. And so when you just look at numbers, you're not able to determine whether that tube was indicated or whether a less invasive intervention would have done as well or perhaps better. And over the past couple of years, as we've been paying attention to the literature that comes out, we decided to shift away from a focus of looking at endotracheal intubations and instead look at, was this provider able to adequately respond to and manage a patient with a critical airway problem? So we had to define that. And the stab that we took at defining it was an O2 stat of less than 90% and a respiratory rate of less than 10 or greater than 30 per minute on initial evaluation. And so then we said, for people who transport that are going to be with the patient for the duration of the call, we would say that successful management of that airway could be determined by an O2 sat of equal to or greater than 95% on entry into the emergency department. And that we wanted to see documentation of vitals, Q5, documentation of lung sounds, and initiation of therapy using appropriate protocol, meds, and devices. So there's some subjectivity in that. We're still learning as we go. One of the things we found is not all patients who, when you read the call chart, are critical, abide by the definition that we laid out. And so we've had to work with the people who do that evaluation to do some norming on what it is that we're looking for. And the medical director eventually gets her eyes on that information. For non-transporting, we have the same definition of what is a critical patient, less than 90 O2 sat, respiratory rate less than 10 or greater than 30 on initial assessment. But there, instead of saying, well, you have to achieve an SpO2 of 95% or greater, what we say is we want vitals charted, we want lung sounds charted, we want to see that you initiated therapy appropriately with the protocol and meds and devices within your scope, and that if you're on scene for 5 minutes or more before EMS arrives, that the O2 sat is beginning to trend up. And we understand, of course, that O2 sats can really trend quite a few minutes behind an intervention. So we're still learning on this, but we shifted it away from the idea that successful airway management is to go to the biggest gun that you have and put it in place.
Right. So the perspective of your office is to look at successful airway management more broadly, not specifically at that one skill. Mike, I guess, you know, so if someone theoretically had a 50% success rate at intubation, provided their airway management was sound, that would be somewhat of a non-issue, presumably. You know, you'd perhaps look at that person and say you need some remedial on ventricular intubation, but on the whole, your airway management's good because, you know, patients are getting treated with either basic life support measures and their O2 sats are trending upwards. Is that, would that be a fair kind of summary of?
Yeah, that's a fair summary. And when we see lower success rates, one of the things that we really work to do is give that person an opportunity, not just in the lab with the mannequin, but also to get into the OR suite. One of our associate medical directors works anesthesiology, and so we have a wonderful opportunity for people who need remediation to put them in the OR with an anesthesiologist who was a paramedic before that, and they get one-on-one instruction throughout the day. You know, as Bill, you've attested numerous times in our discussions, you can go into the OR in search of a tube and come out pretty disappointed at the end of the day because nobody got intubated. And we see that as well. It can be pretty tough to get those intubation experiences for people, but we've seen a lot of value just in spending the time one-on-one with, in our case, this particular physician, that we feel like that's time well spent, and that's how we really try to go after those deficiencies.
I often wonder how honest paramedics are when it comes to laryngoscopy. You know, are they documenting each attempt, or are they just documenting the one time they scoped and got the tube in place? Either of you have kind of a sense of that? You know, I always find credentialing bodies like the base hospital system we have here, they encourage us to be open about our failures and our successes and assure us that nothing bad will come to us if we're, you know, honest and upfront.
Yeah.
But, you know, it is a perpetual fear in the back of the paramedic's mind that if they're down to a 60% success rate because they do laryngoscopy, but they always get it on the second attempt, that's going to not bode well for them. Any sense of what the perception is out in I guess in your area, or Bill in yours?
You know, go ahead, Bill.
I think we may have two different approaches that we take to it. We've had, I think, a very successful program that we've had instituted since 2000 here. We have a small group of 9 individuals that are trained to conduct a oral interview with whoever is involved in advanced airway placement. And they have a defined sheet that they go through with them and ask them a number of questions and write down comments and everything. And that often leads to a good description of exactly what transpired as it related to advanced airway management. And that interview sheet coupled with the patient care report really can give a good picture of what takes place. And I'll tell you that it's robust, but I think it leads to some of the best information that even if there was one or two paramedics that may not be as truthful as you hope they were, the majority are, and I think that we're getting very good information.
That sounds a little intimidating to me.
Well, it certainly can be. We actually modeled ourselves after the work that Marion Grouche did in the pediatric airway management study in L.A. because they had done it through oral interviewing. And you increase the reliability of your information by an oral interview versus just straight self-reporting.
Right.
And when you're dealing with practitioners that are only attempting advanced airway management once or twice a year at the most in the field, how good can they be at remembering all the questions or how the form should be filled out or how accurately the information should be portrayed, where if you deal with a group, we currently now have 9 individuals that are trained, 3 on each of our 24-hour shifts that collect that information. And it's much easier for me to work with those 9 individuals than it is to try to work with something like John, 800-some-odd providers.
Yeah.
Yeah, and Bill's model there, Rob, is one that we are slowly moving to. Mm-hmm. And that certainly fits in line with another initiative strongly underway within Sedgwick County EMS, which is the Just Culture Initiative and Crew Resource Management, where we do make it safer for people to admit that they made a mistake.
Right. Good. Well, I don't want to spend too much time on intubation because we are getting close to the end of the hour. But I have another question for you. So, where our base hospital system, which is a credentialing body essentially, provides medical oversight. They describe errors in the field in sort of 3 categories: critical errors, major errors, and minor errors. And those criteria are sort of broken down into further detail in order to address breaches and protocols or errors and adverse events that happen in the field. How do you determine whether someone needs remedial or just broadly without, you know, perhaps getting into absolute detail, but how do you determine sort of broadly whether someone needs discipline or they're reaching the point where they need to be deactivated or decertified or whatever term you use, decredentialed?
Yeah, great question. You know, one of the things that we learned early on and have slowly sort of found our way in is recognizing that the check sheet, the test score on the written exam, and the check sheet with its check marks, those are a starting point for a conversation with the individual. They are not definitive in what is going on. So we know, particularly in the practical component, when we pull people into a lab setting and we throw a scenario at them, there's all sorts of artifact in that it begins with, it's a high stakes examination, and tied, they view it very clearly as, this is tied to my ability to earn a living here. And then, of course, you have the artifact that comes from the ability to simulate as well as you want to or not simulate as well as you want to. So those things are all starting points for discussion. And when we find that we have individuals who cause the evaluators concern that they're saying, ooh, I don't think I'd be comfortable with this person working on me or someone I care a lot about, that's their clue to pass that information on with the check sheets to say, someone needs to take a look here. And that look begins with a discussion that involves the agency, and it is a discussion with the individual to determine what's behind the deficiency in performance. And so we have had we've had people that have effectively, very few people who have effectively been decredentialed, would be the term. The medical director has said, I am not comfortable with this person working for me. That generally is tied to a host of other issues that are going on with that individual. And credentialing was simply the tool that brought it to a head. Now, the other group, and the group that I think we feel pretty good about, is a group that they weren't decredentialed, but we did determine this person really needs some education and training to get back up to where they can function in the standard skill set that we define as being the minimum that we want. And so we've placed those people with an individual education plan with another provider who oversees ongoing education on calls, and the training division then works with that individual in terms of readings, one-on-one training interventions, perhaps on skills, or a common area is in medications. So they'll work with them in that regard, and then they'll come back in and challenge the credentialing examination process again, and we get success, they're more comfortable. The feedback we generally get in those situations is, you know, I really needed this. I, for whatever reason, I just sort of let things go and quit paying attention. And in some cases, folks show up to work scared to death of what it is that they're going to encounter. But the fear of that doesn't supersede the fear of change in practice and study and so forth. And so that's the group where we feel like we've really made the most impact. And then the other thing that credentialing has done for us is it has highlighted system issues that we would simply not have known. And I'll give you a quick example. Medication administration, it's one thing to be able to calculate the dose. What we found is it's another thing to give the right volume. And so in our credentialing process, what we've discovered is a fairly significant number of providers who they can work through the medication administration process and calculate the correct dose of medication, but then give the wrong volume.
And the wrong dose, presumably, if it's the wrong volume.
Yeah, wrong volume equates to the wrong dose. That's exactly right. But
that's not good.
It's charted correctly. I mean, from the charting, they've charted, well, I gave, you know, X amount, because they don't realize the error. So, you know, from that, what we've found are a couple of areas where we have really had to dig in and redesign processes on our end, particularly from training, that we no longer allow you just to talk through and tell us how much. We want to see you give it.
And do you like to see them document the volume as well, just as a kind of a second check?
We really like to see that. One of the things, and this is a pretty contemporary issue for us that we're working with, Rob, we're in the process of refining what we call a medication administration cross-check. It's a safety check that is a process between two providers that covers essentially the five rights information and verifies the volume to be given. And so we want to standardize that within the system so that anybody who's giving a medication, be they paramedic level, EMT level, advanced level, if they're giving a medication, they work through this same cross-check procedure in order to try and correct what we believe are undocumented errors that are occurring in medication administration.
It's interesting. It reminds me of a book called The Checklist Manifesto.
Ah, yes.
Yeah. By Atul Gawande, I want to say his name is. Yeah. Gawande.
And that's just so you know, that's his third book. He's written two previous books to that actually lead up to the checklist, and they're both as equally as good to read.
Interesting. And what about errors in other than the medication error, the volume error, what about what kinds of error or errors in the field would lead to a decredentialing? Can it be one event that might lead to sort of a remedial, or is it a series of events that would?
No, one event can lead to remediation, but one of the things we're increasingly doing, and boy, I want to be careful here not to claim this. There are some folks over at Sedgwick County EMS that are just doing a wonderful job of pushing just culture and crew resource management into their organization. But you know, one of the fundamental questions there is to determine, was this an error or was this reckless behavior? And that really then provides the framework for how you go about working with the individual. And because reckless behavior, that's something of its own that needs to be dealt with pretty swiftly. But an error, what we really are learning here, and Paul Massassi, Dave Johnston, and Scott Hadley, the director there, are really doing a great job of pushing this forward, to take the time to figure out what led to the error. Was it a lack of knowledge? Was it an equipment issue? Was it a process issue? Was it a packaging issue? What is it that led to that? And if we can identify that, then instead of beating people up and issuing yet another series of paperwork, we might actually be able to prevent the error from occurring again.
The one that comes to mind for me is a colleague of mine who had a patient with an unstable tachyarrhythmia at 2 o'clock in the morning and contacted a base hospital physician, got an order to provide synchronized cardioversion, and made one attempt. And on the second attempt, the patient went into VF, and quickly realized that he had neglected to hit the sync button, and that put the guy into VF, and then he shocked him a third time and got a pulse back, lucky for him and the patient. And you know, you're kind of left with, how do you deal with that? So that individual got a kind of, we call it here, a deactivation, got an immediate deactivation followed by an immediate reactivation, because it just seemed like, this has got to go on your record, and obviously this is a serious mistake and could have been fatal, but how do you remediate that? He knew it was terrible, and the poor guy beat himself up for 24 to 48 hours before he met with the medical director over it.
That's a classic example of a situation where you likely couldn't do anything to make the person feel worse or learn better.
Yeah.
Well, but the question, Rob, is, can you count that as a field save?
That's he's neurologically intact, so I say yes. You nearly killed him, but you saved him. So
that's a stretch.
That is a stretch, I know, yeah. Okay. Well, you know what? We've
done an hour.
We've come to the end of the hour. And John, it's been great having you on the show, and you have a gift for speaking, and I've really enjoyed listening to you talk about your program there. Where can people get a hold of you if they want to ask you more about what you do and pick your brain?
Well, email is probably the best way, Rob, and the email is jfriesen@sedgwick.gov. So that's JF as in Frank, RIES like in Sam, EN, at Sedgwick, which is SamEDogGWICK.gov.
And does your office have a website?
We do not have a public website. Okay. We operate an internal website. So
a covert operation, I see.
yeah, Black Ops, that's right.
Okay, Bill, any final thoughts?
Thanks, John. It's a pleasure to have you back on with us. It was great. Even though we talk a great deal more than this, it was still nice to have this chat tonight.
Well, it was very much an honor to be here, so thanks, guys.
All right, well, that wraps up episode 134 of the EMS Educast. I want to thank all of our listeners in the United States, Canada, and around the world for tuning in to us on iTunes U. We really appreciate your patronage. And we encourage you to visit our Facebook site at facebook.com/EMSEducast. And you can find myself, Bill, and Greg on Twitter. And have a great night.